Hi, I'm Nigel Campbell, editor of Jazz in the Islands magazine, with another episode of Island Jazz Chat, a podcast featuring conversations with Caribbean jazz and pan jazz musicians based in the islands and the diaspora. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Island Jazz Chat. Tonight, we have the pleasure of speaking to globe-trotting steel pan jazz artist, pioneer in a sense, and prolific recording artist, Andy Norell. Hello, Andy. How are you?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm fine. I understand you just...
Good to see you, man. It's been a while.
It's a very, very long time. I understand that you're just back from Japan. And as I said, you're a globe-trotting musician. South Africa, the Caribbean, well, Africa, Caribbean, Europe, North America. What happened in Japan that we need to know about?
Man, you would have loved it. It's just even... You know, when I first went to Japan... It was in the 1980s, and there was nobody playing pan. There were no pans there.
So why did you go? If there was nobody,
I had gigs. I was playing jazz.
Mm-hmm.
As far as like steel band music, it wasn't happening yet.
Mm.
And now they're like must be like about 1,000 people in Japan playing pan.
Wow!
And the level of playing is just. It's just amazing. It just blew me away again. And how much joy these people play with, you know, they get it. They love this music. They love this instrument. They love doing this. You know, I went there for a week of rehearsals. We had about 25 hours of rehearsals over a period of a week. Part of it, most of it was with a set with a band called Fantastics who are from Kobe.
Mm-hmm.
They had about a 25 piece band, and then we did the passage with that piece I did with Trinidad All Stars at Queens Hall, and mm-hmm. and we did that.
You made an album of that name with Calypso Association.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And we did that with 50 players, and it was just I was so moved by it. I mean, just how much love these people have for doing this, for the music, and for playing steel band music. There were 9-year-old kids out there that played good already, you know. It's happening over there. It really is.
Steel pan to the world. Well, as part of your role, and we'll get into that down the road, whether people are a fan of that, but certainly your role in spreading the gospel of steel pan to other parts of the world. Let's go all the way back to the beginning. I remember, actually many years later, discovering that you had made an album in 1966 called The Steel Bandits. And I think a lot of our listeners know your story about your father establishing a steel pan as a social program in New York. But you and your brother, Jeff, another pan jazz musician, had done an album called Steel Bandits.
It was called The Steel Bandits Play.
The Steel Bandits Play on Decca Records. I have some notes here, right? How did that come about? And then we'll go forward in terms of your recording career.
Wow. You know, I don't even remember how we got connected with I remember the guy's, the producer's name is, his name is Henry Jerome. Mm-hmm. And he had done quite a few records, but I don't remember how we actually connected with him.
Mm.
At the time, we were playing 100 gigs a year.
Wow. You know,
I was, by the time I was like, we started when I was 8 years old, we had the band already. And by the time I was 10, we had to get union cards because we were playing in the hotels in Manhattan. And for that, you had to have a union card.
Wow, professional.
And we started, you know, playing like more and more gigs. And then we got we hooked up with a cruise ship line called Grace Line. We started playing for sailings and ended up kind of sending us out to country clubs to play where they could sell lots of cruises. So they would give the band, they would give the band to a country club and we'd go entertain the people, you know. That was my introduction to country club culture. You
but
know,
you were under 18, so you're a minor.
Yeah. Well, my father was managing us and driving us around and being the adult. And we were all minors. You know, I mean, the whole band, I was the youngest one, but we were all underage. We were all card carrying professional musicians, you know.
That's the way the business runs. Say what?
So, where are we? The album. Yeah, that was, you know what? I think we were at that, like I say, at that point, we were playing about 100 gigs a year. We came down to Trinidad for the National Music Festival in 1966. We played at Queen's Hall. And again, it was Graceline that footed the bill to bring us down, and we played on the boat on the way back.
Wow.
And we did a couple television shows around that time, big, major national TV shows like Ed Sullivan,
yes, Hullabaloo. I know that's, yeah, that was a famous. There's a video online in YouTube with you and Ed Sullivan.
Oh, yeah, me and Ed, you know.
Now, here's some more youngsters, an exciting group of American youngsters from Long Island's Queen College, who call themselves, although they play around with queens out there, I understand, you date them all the time, the Steel Bandits.
You are the Beatles. But say, you know, what?
It's really interesting when you look at Sullivan. Sullivan looked like such a hick, you know. I mean, in the way he talked and everything, and he would get everybody's names wrong and all this kind of stuff, make a lot of mistakes. But man, he was the guy that presented all the black artists.
James
Brown. And everybody's first major national television appearance, like Stevie Wonder, Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles, you know. You name it, you know. Everybody was on Ed Sullivan. And
I don't know who owns his archive now, but of course, well, everybody knows about the Beatles. That's like the famous one. But you're quite right. He had the plethora of that opening cast of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We're all in a show. If all the Rock and Roll Hall of Famers started, it seems, at the Ed Sullivan show.
Yeah.
So that's a portent to you, but All right, so beyond the Steel Bandits, there was a kind of gap up to 1979 when you did Hidden Treasure. I'm assuming between 66 and 79, you went to college to do music. What was your degree in music, if that is the degree? And where was it?
Yeah, I went to UC Berkeley and University of California at Berkeley. And that's where I was living. And that was basically like going to a state school. And it was affordable at that time. And I started out as a pre-med. And I was taking like, you know, physics and chemistry and biology and math and all that stuff. And at one point I got curious about what was happening in the music department. I was teaching steel band music from the time I was like, I hit my 16th birthday. I got a driver's license and I started teaching steel band music in Oakland, California. So I was doing some music. So I went over to the music department. I just took a placement test just for the heck of it and just started taking classes, you know. And midway through college, I got pretty disillusioned with the idea of being a doctor and realized I wanted to play music. You know,
Dr. Norell became the maestro. And,
well, you know, like, you know, basically I came from a family where the expectations were like literally spelled out, you know, like go to medical school.
That is how it was in the Caribbean too. Doctor or lawyer. End of story.
Go to medical school, find the cure for cancer and win the Nobel Prize. You know, that was like my mom was out front about it, you know. So, you know, to say, well, you know what? I think I'm not going to medical school. I'm going to be a, I'm just going to play music. It was kind of a shock to the family. But by that time, you know, my father was such a maverick, and he's the one that got me into this whole thing, that they accepted it. But they put the same kind of crazy expectations for me about music that they had about everything else.
What was your degree in?
I finished with a Bachelor of Arts, you know, in music, major in music. Yeah, the curriculum was pretty classical. There wasn't much else.
Yeah. What year was that?
I graduated at the end of 73.
73. Thinking like I was recently watching a Pat Metheny interview. He had gone to University of Miami, and well, he was not that good. So they said, go and teach. Well, those are the years. But he made his point that they weren't teaching jazz beyond Berkeley and I think University of Texas. They weren't teaching jazz studies. But as you said, at UC Berkeley, you were doing classical music. When did jazz come up in your life to be, okay, this is the direction I'm going with, and I'm going to use a steel pan as my lead instrument?
Well, actually, much earlier. You know, I when I was about 13 or so, I my parents got me an AM/FM radio. I discovered WLIB which was a jazz station broadcasting from Harlem, and they had the DJs were amazing. They had, and the guy that really hooked me in was Dr. Billy Taylor, who was a great jazz pianist himself and had played with all the greats, and was also like the most knowledgeable musicologist in jazz at the time and throughout till the end of his life. So the things that he had to say about the musicians and the connections that he was making about who was doing, where this came from and who was working with whom, it just hooked me in, you know, and I was like, wow, could I be like that? You know, could that actually, and so all my role models were like these jazz musicians, you know, that the guys I wanted to be like were like Miles Davis, Wayne Shorter, Herbie Hancock, Elvin Jones, Bill Evans, you know. And fortunately, I think I picked the right heroes, because, you know, that generation of musicians, all the way going back, I don't know if you've seen, like, Robin Kelly wrote an amazing book about Thelonious Monk, which it's a biography, and it describes the whole music scene in New York in the 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s. And it's just the way those people were living the music. They were just living it full time, and they set the bar so high. These guys were playing.
And they were developing a brand new genre almost, in a sense.
At the same time. Mm-hmm. And they were doing it like five sets a night, six nights a week and a gig would last for 5 months.
I heard that. And finally, it would be 4 o'clock in the morning. Those kind of stories,
And we listened to those records, and we wonder how they were playing at such a level, you know, at that level. But they were living the music in a way that I don't think any of us realize is even possible today. People, it's not our culture anymore.
Easier said than done. But so your experience with LIB, listening, having your heroes, what motivated you to say, okay, Hidden Treasure, let's record. Let's record something that became Hidden Treasure. What was that pathway?
Well, you know, one of the things that I started like trying to improvise within the context of a steel band. And then there was a guy that came and played guitar with us in our steel band who was a good jazz guitar player. And he told me, you know, why don't you come down to the Village with me? There's a jam session on Sundays. I'll introduce you. You can come sit in. You know, I was 15. And so it was like a bus and two subway trains to get down to the Village, my stand and my tenor pan and stuff. And I'd come in, and it's this guy named Major Holly, who was like a very, very serious jazz bass player, who was hosting the sessions.
Quincy Jones had him. He hums when he plays.
Right.
Yeah, Quincy Jones had him on the Frank Sinatra album. Major Holly. Yeah.
Major Holly, there were two bass players who were known for singing what they played. It was Slam Stewart and Major Holly. Great proponents of that. And, you know, I was so amazed by him. And Kenny Barron came and sat in one day. And, you know, just the kind of like, and, you know, Mingus was playing down the block and he came over to hang out with Major on the break, you know? So it was like, wow, here I am in the real thing. And he let me play, you know, and he was kind of mystified by my whole being there. He would never remember my name, but he'd call me things like the black man's white man, on steel band, you know? And then I moved out to California and I just kind of like was doing different things musically. I was playing in a rock band where I was playing a B3 organ and I was teaching steel band music and I was going to school studying classical music and I was playing piano in the jazz band at school. And I was hanging out with my brother and some people that were all into Latin music. So I would go and hang with them and play some congas, you know, and get turned on to Brazilian music and Afro-Cuban music. And that's kind of around the same time when I was in school. And, you know, as I was getting finished with school, I wanted to like write some music and do something like Chick Corea was doing with Return to Forever. He had this band with Flora Purim, and he was playing Fender Rhodes, and Ayrto was on drums, and Joe Farrell and Stanley Clark.
Stanley Clark on bass, yeah.
And, you know, it was sort of like, wow, I just started thinking about how I could play pan in a situation like that, you know, and realize that nobody is going to hire me, you know, because they don't see it. I gathered that really early on, you know, at a very young age. I realized, you know, it's not going to happen if I just wait for people to call me or something like that. I'm going to have to, if I'm going to try to establish the pan as a melodic instrument in jazz and figure out who I am and do that, I'm just going to have to do it.
Do it yourself, yeah.
So I went straight, pretty much. It was one thing. I started working in the studio a lot and I met some really good musicians. I was arranging on commercials and things like that. And I would arrange rhythm section and horn charts and strings. And this was right when I got out of school. And it was just basically learning on the job. And I had a mentor. His name was Bernie Krause, and he hired me and he let me just learn in the studio, you know, just figure it out. And I met a very fine saxophone player named Mel Martin. And we, you know, I came to him with some music I had written and he liked it and said, let's get a band. You know, the idea was get a band together. And he knew a lot of good players. And so he called friends and this band was called Listen. And we started going out and playing. We played a lot of gigs around the Bay Area. Great American Music Hall and Keystone Corner. And, you know, we played at the colleges and some of the smaller clubs. And that was really like my first experience playing in a jazz group on stage in front of people. And we were playing all original music. The original drummer in the band was Terry Bozzio. You ever heard his name?
He's the one with a million drums.
Yeah.
this drum kit with about 50 toms and 25 cymbals.
That's the guy. That's the guy. And he was an amazing player, you know, but really loud. So it made us into a loud band. And that was the first and last time I ever just would play in a band that was that loud. You know, I just realized I can't do this. I can't hear myself and I'm going to go deaf doing this. And it's not working for me. So then we got a different drummer, George. He left because Terry went to go play with Frank Zappa. So he left after just a few months. And then we got George Marsh and we kept it going. So, you know, it was in that period that I just started thinking of writing and thinking about doing my own thing. The first person I went to was Kenneth Nash, who was a percussionist that I had seen play with a lot of people at Keystone Corner in San Francisco. And I asked him if he'd be interested in doing this. And then I got Steve Urquiaga, who was a guitar player that great rhythmic feel, great jazz feel, you know, and we connected. And I put a quartet together and just started trying to play some gigs locally. And that's when that album that you asked about, I actually did a demo of a couple of tracks, just financed it myself, went in the studio, and then I sent it to Inner City Records.
Inner City Records.
Because that, I guess that was, that had gone back to, Listen did a record, the group that I was talking about. We did a record for Inner City.
And oh, they did?
And Irv, yeah. And it's got a Easter Island on the cover. I was actually gone already, and I came back. I had left the group, and I came back to do the album. So I'm on a, some of the tracks. I don't even think I'm on all of them. But Irv had said to me, he said, you know, let me know if you want, if you do your own thing, I'd be interested in hearing it. So I sent him the demo, and he signed.
He said yes.
He signed me to do the, to finish the album and do it for Inner City.
There you go, Hidden Treasure.
And that's the story of that record.
That's it.
It was that band, like those four of us, we really did some crazy stuff. I would book these 20 concert tours in Europe. It would take us a month or two or something like that. And we just hump all our own gear all over. We had no roadies. We had no maps.
That's how it is.
We'd be going into a city and in Germany, and we wouldn't speak German, and we didn't know how to get to the hotel or the venue or anything. We just go to the center of town and start asking people, you know, where's this?
The adventures of touring at the beginning of your career.
You know, and carrying all our own equipment around and dealing with everything. It was just crazy.
That quartet, well, you had two names, Kenneth Nash and Steve Urquiaga. What was the basis? Because I'm thinking that the next three albums you did, Stickman, Light in Your Eyes, and Slow Motion, and Hip Pocket Records, I think that's the label. There was a fourth. What was the name of your bassist? Because I think that was the name.
Well, in the beginning, it was Rich Gerard. And then he left. He couldn't take it anymore. The the humping the gear.
Yeah, sloshing around your equipment. And all he had was a bass. So if he had a pan.
And that was like the first three albums. And then through Light in Your Eyes. And then with Slow Motion, that was when I changed the band because Rich left and we got Keith Jones on bass. Keith
Jones, yes.
And when Keith came in, I also got Will Kennedy to come play drums because Kenneth was playing percussion and drums. I was even playing drums. We were switching around. And
you also played piano, which I was unaware because on one of those early albums, could it be Stickman Self? You have one of those songs that there's a piano solo, right? Goes into a kind of crescendo. And I remember telling you this in post, and I said, oh my God, that's a great piano solo. And your comment was, well, I wasn't all that good back then, right? So my little island
still
is...
still not that good.
So my island is, I said, wow, this fellow's a good piano player, but there you go. There you go. So you said,
It's
all relative, admitted, right? Yeah. So Steve Okiaga, I remember that name being a consistent name and Keith Jones as a consistent name, Will Kennedy, because the first album that I bought was a vinyl album of The Hammer, David Rudder's song.
Will Kennedy
in 87, yes. And yeah. I had read in a magazine, somebody had asked about steel pan players and your name came up. And admittedly, in 86, I'd never heard of you. Right. And I'm thinking, who's this? And in Israel, we have Robbie Greenidge, we have Othello Molyneux. I'm just calling names. And this journalist in a magazine was saying, no, Andy Nirelli has multiple albums. And I saw the album in a record store in Trinidad, bought it. Of course, I know The Hammer. It was a huge hit in Trinidad. And then I heard you playing and then I realized, oh, this is a jazz musician playing pan. And oh, yeah, the quality of the recording is excellent. Oh, and he's on a label, independent label, all the same. These are the things that I was looking for in terms of how we disperse our music throughout the world. When I say our music, I mean steel pan music and even pan jazz to an extent. And you had already started that. And at this point, of course, you had about 4 or 5 albums up to this point and thing. But going forward, you were able to, of course, write your own music. You were able to explore rhythms outside of the kind of understood panorama or calypso, soca rhythm kind of stuff. You were exploring Latin rhythms, as it was. As I said, I remember a friend of mine gave me an album of yours and it was on a smooth jazz. He said, oh, this is the greatest thing I've heard in smooth jazz. And I said, wow, smooth jazz, steel pan. So there was this movement, certainly through the 80s, probably into the 90s, where you were expanding your reach, your global reach almost. And I'm sure you came to Trinidad because that was the first time I met you. When there was a concert we had in Trinidad, yourself and your brother, Bugsy Sharp, and I want to say Earl Rodney.
And it was Earl Rodney.
And it was set up like a kind of duel, a kind of fight, a kind of Andy versus the Trinidadians, which I let me just preface this to all my listeners. Andy and I have spoken at length about this particular episode. I know that you weren't happy about that particular style of marketing, but you had a sold out house. So, but tell me about how that experience really is in terms of spreading the word of pan and spreading the sound of a steel pan throughout the world. What was that? And certainly a relationship with Trinidad and Tobago, if you want to go there at all.
Well, you know, at that point, I hadn't been back to Trinidad since I was a kid. I was really out of touch with what was happening, except for hearing a few recordings. Mm-hmm. And it was a great shock for me to come down there. You know, first of all, it was, you know, the whole thing about the way it was promoted was pretty hilarious. And I had an understanding with Frank Martino that, like, you know, going into it, I said, look, you do what you have to do to promote the show, but don't ask me to say that. I'm not going to say it. I'm not going to get on the microphone when I come to Trinidad and say that I come to beat these guys, you know? Yeah. So you're going to have to deal with that. So and he was like, cool. We can deal with that. And I come down there. And it's like the show is being promoted as the International Pan Showdown, and it's being promoted like a prize fight. Mm-hmm. And I walk out of the terminal at Piarco, and the first thing I said, I put one foot on the sidewalk, and somebody says to me, hey, Norell, I hope you got something for Boogsy Saturday night, because I know Boogsy got something for you, boy. You know, it was like, welcome to Trinidad. Yeah, and it was like, the thing was, that was a show. And we were, you know, we went on television and when the interviewer asked me, what is this, a concert? Is this a competition? Is this a, and Frank knew that I wasn't going to give the right answer. Mm-hmm. And he jumped in and said, it's a war. You know, and he had Boogsy doing all these inflammatory commercials and stuff like that. But in the meantime, we were hanging, you know, and I was getting to be friends with Boogsy, and like, you know, we were going to hear Charlie's Roots. Mm-hmm. That's where I first heard David Rudder. Where I went, me and Boogsy and some of the other guys, we went to a club and heard them, David singing. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, when I came back, that kind of got the thing, you know, I realized I got to come back, you know, and I came back to the following carnival to play in Panorama. That was the first time I did.
What band you played with?
After that gig, I played with Phase Two and Renegades.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And in those days, playing with two bands was considered very radical. It's not like today where you play with 9 bands.
I was not going to say that.
Nobody played with two bands in those days. You couldn't split your loyalty like that. Mm-hmm. It wasn't accepted, you know. Mm-hmm. Back at that time.
I got you.
So I was, you know, catching, you know, it was like, wow. But I really got turned on to like the sound of the big band and the sound of big sections and realizing, and that changed my whole perspective about what I was doing in the studio on my records. Mm-hmm. I started like thinking in terms of like, well, all these bands, that's my instrument now. I can do stuff with larger sections and whole bits of using the whole steel band as my instrument. Because I can overdub this stuff, you know. So, and the other thing that kind of really affected me was hearing like really getting hip to like how Boogsy and Robbie and Earl were using a double second, and I wasn't. Mm-hmm. I knew how to play it, but I was still solo. I was a tenor pan soloist still, and I decided to change. You know, I was like 30 years old, and just decided I'm playing the wrong instrument. I got to start practicing and focusing on the double second, which is what I've been doing ever since.
Ever since, yeah. You know? I've always said, well, Robbie actually is the one who, the tone of it just said, oh, this is what a pan supposed to sound like. Not that a tenor pan doesn't sound like a pan, right? But to me, it's always very tinny. I know Rudy Smith plays a double second. Othello plays a tenor pan, but yourself, Robbie, Ray Holman, and I said, oh, this is what it's supposed to be. That's the intro. And of course, now Bugsy famously does the double second. So that was it. But you just said, you're going to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, Robbie was the first guy to really take a double second in the studio and play softly and get that sound that he was the first, you know, got really turned me on to it. You know, it's like, oh, you could do this with the double second, you know, you just like play soft. Use the mics, and this has got the so much warmer sound than a tenor pad. More range.
Yeah.
And, you know, you listen to like just the two of us. It's a classic, you know, what he did.
Number one song.
And it was pioneering that, you know.
Very much so. Robbie playing, just the two of us, warm song. Something you just said, actually, about the idea of the sections and that kind of stuff. I know that by the time you got, and this is a little further down the road, by the time you got to the passage, which you performed with Calypso Association in France and Tattoo in 06 to 2006, which you basically played all the parts of a small steel band, which to the ear sounded, oh, this is pretty unique. But I think before that, you had started to arrange for steel bands, Our Boys in Tobago, Skiffle in Trinidad, or ultimately Birdsong. What was that experience?
Skiffle was later. I mean, actually, you know, I started, you know, as like I told you, I was in the late 80s and I was starting to study steel band music, you know, like by listening to the bands and like going and playing and studying what these arrangers were doing. I came back the following year and played with Bugsy and Ray. I was in the performance of Pan Woman. And hanging out with him at his house while he was working on the arrangement and you know, so I those next few records, you know, you could see more and more sections of Pan. By the time I got to doing Down the Road and the Longtime Band, there were full steel bands on my records. In fact, Slow Motion, let me think about it. No, it's Little Secrets. The one after the
1989,
Hammer.
After the Hammer.
One after the Hammer has like a full steel band arrangement on We Kind of Music. And it has a piece for steel band at the end called The Song Lines. And the next one down the road had like a few pieces for steel band that I wrote. And then one by Vince Mendoza, where I got him to compose a whole suite of music for steel orchestra. So I was already like doing this thing of overdubbing all the pans and playing a full steel band. What kind of really changed for me was getting my hands on an actual steel band, which happened in like 99 when I got to do Coffee Street with Skiffle Bunch. And I did Panorama for 2 years. And then I moved over to Calypso Station, where I came over here and had a 60-piece band for the European Steel Fan Festival in 2002. And that's what I wrote the passage for.
Okay.
And
when did you do the Our Boys arrangement, though? I was just trying to get the chronology.
Back in the 80s.
That was in the 80s. And you made a couple of, you produced like a couple of records for them.
It was before I knew what I was doing with steel band music. It was my experimental, could I write a Panorama tune? No. No, but you know, our boys wanted to do it and at Panorama, and I was turned down. Pantroon Bagel wouldn't let me do it.
Oh, you have that ugly episode. I hear you.
But in fact, the person who was the leader of our boys was Patrick Arnold.
Patrick Arnold.
Then became president of
Pantroon Bagel.
Pantroon Bagel. And he made it clear that they were going to, I was going to be welcome. You know, he made me welcome there and invited me to come down and arrange and invited me to come in front of the whole, the board of directors, whatever we call those guys, and just said right in front of everybody, I just want to make sure you know that you're welcome here and that there's, you know, there's not going to be anything from Pantroon Bagel saying that you shouldn't be here.
A little detente, a little diplomacy there. But I think it was I think it's important. As I said, well, you and I knew we've spoken about this, and I wrote an essay about call it An American in Paradise, a kind of riff of An American in Paris, about the acceptance of people, Trinidadians, that is, to you, one, as a panist, a steel pan musician. I don't know if you use that word panist. I understand it's a bad word for professional musicians, but certainly your forays in arrangement, and there have been, you know, reactions and that kind of thing. But I think it's important for everybody to recognize, regardless of what happened in Trinidad, you had a space, as you said, in Japan, you just came back from there, in Asia, in Africa, South Africa. I know there was a South African era in U1. You did a whole live album, Live in South Africa. You did the Arts Alive, where I understand where 60,000 people were there to hear you. So, I mean, Andy Narell and the Andy Narell Pan song has made its way around the world. How the reactions happen here in the land of steel band is something that happens. I mean, I'm sure Americans hated the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin because they were taking, quote-unquote, our music and becoming super successful with it. But I think critical for what is happening is that you are recording and recording and recording. And I think, certainly for the purposes of this podcast, you created a body of music that is right now unrivaled in terms of recordings. The next most prolific artist that I could calculate, I think, is Rudy Smith, with about 10 or 12 albums. You already have 18 albums as a leader, two with Sake Show, two with Caribbean Jazz Project. Has Caribou made a record? Just curious.
No, we haven't done a full album yet. We just played a couple gigs though about a month ago. And so, you know who was playing in the band now? It's Ron Reed.
Ron Reed on bass. Yes, yeah. I noticed that.
Which was really cool.
Yeah. So all that aside, I think I just want to make sure that we keep the focus on the fact that Pan Jazz has a global audience because of Andy Narell. Let's just put that statement there. Well, yes, there have been musicians.
It might be an exaggeration.
Well, as I said, I'm not denying that Othello Molyneux had an important role to play. I'm not denying that Rudy Smith had an important role to play. There were other pioneers, Robbie Greenidge, working with Ralph McDonald, had an important role to play. But I still, if you have to take data points, we have to go with recordings, and recordings are recordings. In 2000, when you did Live in South Africa, you had about 12, 13 albums at that point. So that's a body of music that cannot be denied. But be that as it may, your experiences in Trinidad, you were continuing to make recordings and that kind of stuff. And one of the things that I was always keen to understand was you made some songs. I call them songs that, to me, needed lyrics. But I know you're dead set against lyrics for a number of your songs. You did songs. You did Long Time Band. You did The Hammer. I think Chocolate Fog or something like that. David wrote some lyrics for it. But tell me about your compositional process. Do you want songs or do you just want music that is not lyric based?
Well, first of all, I'm not dead set against lyrics. In fact, I was thrilled and honored that Stalin wrote words to one of my songs and
Which
put
one?
It on his album, you know, Appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I had already written the music and he heard it and he said, I want to put words to this and sing it. Mm-hmm. And he put it out. And he held up his album and waited till we had that track, you know, and to finish it. And, you know, like you said, David's written some words, but that was an actual Panorama tune. So I actually did have a Panorama tune with lyrics, you know.
Okay.
And the point is that's just a kind of a reality of dealing with Trinidad and the environment around it, the whole politics of Panorama and all this stuff, and everybody said you have to have it. You know, originally they told Ray Holman that you know, you can't do your own thing either, even if you do have lyrics. Mm-hmm. It has to be a Calypsonian, and he got opposition all the way up to Kitchener and Sparrow were opposed to him.
I remember that.
And you know, I think the point, people kind of miss the point when they think, well, Boogsy had lyrics, you know. Yeah, Boogsy actually wrote very simple vehicles for what he wanted to do, which was experiment with steel band music. You know, I think, you know, for somebody to look at Boogsy Sharp's music for Panorama and say, well, you see, he has lyrics, you know. I think it kind of misses the point. It's not really what it's about. It's about Bugsy's music, you know? And the way I see it at the time when I was playing this stuff was he was writing very simple vehicles, you know, like basically ba 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 da 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 ba ba dum 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 bom 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 ba do de dum be ba ba dum din din dum. That's the verse. Ba ba dum ba dum ba dum ba ba dum ba dum ba dum dum ba dum ba dum ba dum. That's it. It's a few lines long. And all those songs were like that. Musical Wine, I Music was a little longer. But they were like simple themes that he could take off on wild tangents with, you know, which is what his music was all about. It's like, where is it going to go? And he was like launching these brilliant explorations into unknown territory. And but these songs were just the hooky songs that they, and you know, Denise sang them and they were cool and she sang great and they always had good arrangements and everything like that. But these were just vehicles for what he was really trying to do, which was something else entirely, which is like taking the steel band in a whole different direction.
A whole different direction, yeah.
Clearly. And using all these different influences and everything like that. And that was really an exciting time for me. Mm. And you still, you know, I think there's still that music is really held on. You know, like you go to Brooklyn and you still see Pansides, the old guys playing that music, you know, when they come down, they're playing iMusic and Musical Wine coming down the road.
But songs last forever. That's what I can say. That's my thinking.
And that's what I always wanted to do, you know, is basically play music. I've never was really concerned with like what the judges think or whether I'm going to win this thing or not. You know, I wanted to just play music, you know, like compose music that would be like unique and different and personal, like an expression of myself and like honest, and it would hopefully live on, you mm-hmm. know, and live past the Panorama, because there's so much of this music that goes down. That's just like, it's forgotten the day after Panorama. Nobody cares, mm-hmm. you know, and that's sort of like accepted as like that's a good thing. You know, that's that people tell me that's what you should do. You know,
and that
you should, you should play to the judges. You should play to the competition. You should play to this event, mm-hmm. you know, and stop doing your not for Panorama music. You know, even every year I'd have a debriefing with Dennis Phillip after we would get knocked out of semifinals.
And Birdsong.
Mm-hmm. Birdsong. And he started saying, why are you so stubborn? You know, you know, as if, could you just be a little bit more like Bradley, you know, mm-hmm. like figure out how to give them what they want and mm-hmm. still do your own thing, you know? And I was like, that's tricky. You know, I don't know if I know how to do that. I'm not a strategist, you know, I'm just trying to do honest music.
I think
one
of the things that I've had a conversation with people about that thing. Panorama only happens once a year, right? Admittedly, we could have festivals, and it's a festival, but it's a competition. But you can take your music and your arrangements and go to bands in the college bands in the States, bands in Japan, and have those arrangements played. So the arrangements themselves don't die. So that body of music that is 8 minutes long, based on a theme that is, as I say, 2 lines, 4 bars, 8 bars, whatever the deal is. And that sustains. The other thing that you do, of course, is you record them. So I think by the time you got to, I want to say, We Kind of Music or This One for Raf, those are like in the 2010s, you did a couple albums where you played effectively the arrangements that happened. I think a Birdsong arrangement for We Kind of Music appeared on your album later. You don't hear that anywhere else. Nobody records yeah. the arrangements. So those pieces of music are lost in the real sense.
Right.
I think we're going
to... And the fact that you know, the goal of the music was not to get through this competition. You know,
yeah.
the goal of the music is that it would live on, you know, and that right. there would be, like you say, you know, we're old fashioned in a way, but we still believe in like recordings, you know,
I trust
albums, mm-hmm. you know,
in the real sense.
That's part of my whole plan is I want to do this at Panorama, but I also want to do a definitive record, a well-recorded version of everything.
Everything.
Like, you know, in fact, all four tunes I did with all of the Panorama tunes are on the record. So Last Word was on the Ma Cherie album. But the next three, We Kind of Music, Pan Magic, and this one for Raph, they're all on the album We Kind of Music.
Thank you.
And I did all those one track at a time, one pan at a time.
Overdub, overdub. Well,
overdub, overdub, yeah.
Now, in those experiences, of course, the sound of a pan was made by a person who was using a stick hitting a pan. We have this new evolution. I know some years ago you had spoken about creating a library, a sound library of steel pans, and you recorded and sampled, I should say, the Ellie Manet range of pans, Ellie Manet pioneer, pan creator, a range of steel pan sounds, so that if you listen to it, you say, oh, it's a steel band. But I understand it's all keyboard samples with guest musicians. What you have done recently with Like a Child, a brand new album that you have out, is you've taken the sound of the steel pan, of course, with your new sample. What do you call it? A song library, is that the proper term? With your new song library of Ellie Manet.
Call it a sample library.
Sample, you know, library.
But, this one is called Andy Norell Steel Pans, the Ellie Manet Collection. And what it is a collection of Ellie's instruments. There are 21 of his instruments in there. There are 5 tenor pans, 6 pairs of double seconds, 4 triple guitars, 2 tenor bass, and 4 sets of 6 bass. All those unique instruments have been recorded. They've all been sampled. Mm-hmm. And what that means is every single note gets recorded at 35 or 40 different volumes. And then everything gets organized and balanced. So it's like what you end up having is about 1,000 separate pieces of audio to create an instrument. Meaning, like, you know, 40 versions of this note, 40 versions of that note, et cetera, all the way up the chromatic scale of the instrument. And it, you know, the whole process of like editing and putting this all together and then balancing the whole each instrument, one sample at a time, it's a huge amount of work. And I had to, it was, educate myself on how this whole thing works. You know, it was like a whole new, you know, it's just a whole new field to get into. You know, I was like inside computer software that I'd never done any programming before and never worked with developer kind of a software. And so I had to learn how this thing worked. It was a 5-year learning curve to get it done. But what I was able to do was apply everything I know about recording pans and playing them. First of all, we started with these beautiful instruments. We had them tuned for the sessions. I played the pans. I recorded them. I used the way I've been miking them for the last thousands of sessions and stuff. And it's the same group of instruments that I'm using on these records. That's on Tatum and We Machinery and We Kind of Music. It's those pans. Mm-hmm. And then I mixed all the different combinations together. So you can play one tenor pan. You can play 2, 3, or 5. You know, you can play one double second or any of a half a dozen different double seconds, or you can play 2 of them or 3 of them or 5 or 4 of them at a time. And each one is a different stereo image. And you've actually got all these unique instruments mixed and matched together. And, you know, what I realized at a certain point working on it was like, whoa, this works. Like the whole band, I can play the whole band here. I've got a whole steel band on
at the fingertips.
And that there were things I could do with it that I just couldn't imagine doing on the pans themselves. I mean, because you can do anything that you can do on a keyboard. You can do it, and you can use all the powers of like MIDI editing and all this kind of stuff. You hit a wrong note, I could just go in and fix it. I don't have to punch in and play it. I can just go and change the name of the note. You know, and so, you know, it's very powerful. And to be able to play an improvised line and then just say, you know, I want to hear that in all these different pans and all these different octaves and different mm-hmm. octaves and different intervals. And you just, it's all the power of the computer is all there for you. So I realized I had this kind of a monster on my hands that like there's so many things that are possible with this. Thank you. You know, the most exciting part is like getting this into the hands of people that don't know how to play pans and don't know how to access this, and but to get it into all kinds of music.
So that's the rest of the world. Thank you.
People ask me who's your target market for this, and I'm like, everybody. Okay, so but you know, reality is things happen slowly. You know, it happens 100 copies at a time. You know, but it's not like, you know, we're not out there reaching millions of people with this thing. It's and it's going to take a while to convince more and more to musicians that like what you've got here is like beautiful sounding instruments that like you never had before, and you can do all kinds of stuff with them besides put a Caribbean vibe on your track. You know,
I'm thinking soundtracks right away. Just recently watching how Hans Zimmer puts together a soundtrack, and basically it's everything on a keyboard, and you just hire an orchestra to fill in the violins or something. So, but I know that many years ago, I remember seeing, I think it was Trading Places, I heard a steel pan song, Jerry Goldsmith. Was that you?
It's not Jerry Goldsmith. Trading Places with Elmer Bernstein.
It was me. And it was you, yes. I remember hearing that there was a scene, I'm hearing a steel pan. I was in university in Canada at the time, and of course we were screaming as the future and audience in the audience. It took years before we discovered it was you. But I'm thinking that have you ever written a soundtrack for a film, a video, or anything original?
Yeah, you know, I'm sure you've seen it too. One of the films I've written a lot of music for was called Pan Our Music Odyssey.
Kim Johnson's on film.
Most of the soundtrack for the historical stuff, the reenactment, most of that music is
yours.
Written by me. Yeah, I recorded it.
Yeah,
except for a couple cues there, but I did a lot of them.
Because I'm thinking that with this instrument, or this sound, I should say, and a keyboard, and a very good keyboard player, the sound of the steel pan could be any and everywhere now. And that I'm just thinking there are more keyboard players than steel pan players in the world. This is just my off the top thinking. But the sound of the pan, but the sound of the steel pan.
Wild guess.
Yeah, it could be anywhere. It could be in Antarctica, in the middle of Russia. I don't know. But kudos to you for doing that. But I think it kind of grounds within me the idea that this the pan is something that people have always argued hell hard about, and I know I'm gonna get licks for this, but once it comes out of the bottle, it can't go back in, right? Rock and roll, the blues, soca to a point, reggae, dancehall, once it gets out of the bottle, like a toothpaste, you can't put it back in, kind of thing. So what has happened in terms of your career, your recordings, and now with the development of the sample library, the sound of the pan is global, and it's now a matter for us as creators in the Caribbean, Trinidad, wherever, to utilize the tools to be different, to be unique, to be good, as it was, right? So now that we've kind of followed the arc of a young kid playing in the Seal Bandits play in the 60s, mm-hmm. all the way now to more than 40 something years, probably more than 50 years thinking about it now, playing the sounds of a steel pan on a keyboard. I want to dive a little deeper into the recordings, because as I said, one of the things that I noted on your recordings over time was the development of the different rhythms that you use, exploring Caribbean and tropical rhythms, rhythms from hot latitudes, as somebody had noted. You had Luis Conte, who's top world-class Cuban percussionist on some of your recordings. Of course, you work with Trinidad bands, South African bands, your French Caribbean bands. The different environments in which you work is always intriguing to me. Tell me about those, that exploration of how you wanted to expand the sound of the pan, utilizing all these different rhythms on your different albums, Caribbean Psalm, Caribbean Jazz Project, Sake Show, and of course, I call it your Chakalaka band from Live in South Africa. Mm. How did that develop? Those ideas, where did that come from?
You know, I think, I guess I realized early on that I really didn't want to be like a bebopper. I didn't want to play straight ahead jazz. I didn't want to play standards. I wanted to do something else musically. Mm. And I didn't know exactly what that was. And a lot of what I found, how I found my direction, was by discovering Afro-Caribbean music, and Brazilian music, Afro-Brazilian music, and music from West Africa. And and once you start like studying and exploring and being curious, it you get hooked. You know, and it's a lifelong thing. There's new doors opening for me all the time. You know, one of the things when I moved to Paris, I discovered was like North African music. I didn't know anything about North African music before. And I discovered this whole world of music. And now you can like check out, there's a cut on this album that I did, which is a Karim Ziad composition. And it's the drummer who's playing, who composed the music. He's the drummer on the song. Mm. And it's a guy who's like music. I love his albums, and I've gotten to play with him and so on. So really, you know, one of the things I've discovered over time was that the Caribbean is one of the richest musical environments in the world.
Say that again.
It's got such richness, and it's got such diversity, you know, for me to, you know, to be able to look in terms for inspiration, for ideas, for foundation in the music, to be able to look at all the music of Cuba and all the music of Haiti, and the Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico and the English, you know, and Trinidad and Jamaica, and then the French Caribbean. I discovered I didn't know anything about it. I started going down there to play. My records got kind of popular there in Martinique and Guadeloupe. And so I was able to go play, and I started hearing their music, and I was like, Wow. And I would go home with piles of CDs trying to understand what was going on in this place, you know, learning about Beguine and Zouk and Guoka and Belair and all these, this kind of local music there. And then I got lucky and ran into some of these, you know, got to connect with some of these people. And I connected with people at a very high level. I was like Michel Alibaud and Mario Canoj and Jean-Philippe Fanfan. These guys were like my teachers, you know.
And Mario,
and I was like, and part of it is I've always had that philosophy of like, I'm just going to play with the best people who let me play with them. You know, the best musicians that'll play in my band or let me play in theirs, you know, anybody, you know. And those guys had so much chemistry and so much knowledge between them about the French Caribbean thing, and we just connected and we decided to put a band together. So that was, you know, how that came about. But all the other things with South Africa was like, you know, I had this accident of popularity. I had some hit records over there and I didn't know it. And that's when I went there, I had no idea 60,000 people were coming out. And I realized that I could work in this place, but touring a whole band to South Africa is really expensive. Mm-hmm. And that there were really good musicians here. And there's a whole other world I can get into and play with holy African musicians, you know. And like my band down there is like this mix. There's guys from Soweto, but there's guys from Zimbabwe and there's guys from Mauritius and all over the country, all over Southern Africa, you know. And, you know, so, you know, part of what happened, you know, was in the 90s. In the 80s, was the first chance I actually started becoming viable. In the mid to late 80s, with those albums you were talking about, The Hammer.
Hammer, Little Secrets.
It made it possible for me to start touring a band. And it all dried up 10 years later. You know, I had the Caribbean Jazz Project, and then that was over. And then Smooth Jazz came along and just took me off the radio. And I couldn't get any gigs, you know, and everything changed. And I started going out by myself anywhere I could get a gig. And putting a band together, and realized that I could do this too. You know, I can have a band in Trinidad, I can have a band in New York, I can have a band in Paris, one in Johannesburg, one in Martinique, one in Guadeloupe, one in San Francisco. There were guys all over now that I could send music to. They could learn it. I could rehearse it. Come and rehearse. And I found that I discovered something that was like, I'm actually enjoying this more than touring. Playing every day in a different city, which is what you have to do when you have a whole band out on the road. There's no other way.
You know?
And the other thing that happened to me as a result of that was that I just went back to being really big. I got serious about steel band music, you know, and realized this is a way I can actually get to play my music in a whole different way. Whereas rather than again, the impossibility of touring a steel band, how hard that is, you know, I can teach this music, you know, and there are steel bands.
Hello.
I had a school here in France and there's all the universities in the States and then in South Africa and now Japan, you know, and it changed my life, you know, and to come back to steel band music and dedicate myself to like this kind of music, which is orchestral and which is social and it has all these different kind of benefits, the way it brings people together. And I'm involved with young people and education and getting to play my music at the same time, you know? So, you know, it was sort of like the floor. I mean, the rug getting pulled out from under me, and I felt was totally destabilized, and it all kind of worked out for the best in a way, you know. You know, enjoying myself. If I didn't need the money, I think I'd still be doing exactly what I'm doing, you know.
If you didn't need the money. All right, we won't talk about money. No.
No, well, I tell people that the kids at that when I'm in, you know, sometimes when I'm in teaching at their universities and their schools, you know, and saying, you know, I love this, you know. If you can do what you love, it means so much, you know.
Yeah, it's a passion to work with it. There were a couple albums that I want to talk about. One is the University of Calypso that you did with Relator, where basically Relator sang calypsos as we know it, but you played a couple pan as an accompanying instrument, and you're exploring the calypsos and thing. The other one I want to talk about is actually this one for Raf. I believe it was a 2-CD set. And one of the CD sets was a duet with Janisette McPherson. Janisette came to Trinidad. We brought Jazz Artists in the Greens, brought her in 2019, the last year we had it before COVID. And she mashed up the place with your Margie. I think she told us that you introduced her to Kitchener, Lord Kitchener's Margie. And she closed her set with that, and people were losing their minds. But,
I'll tell you the story behind that. She came to me and said, "Look, I'm going to Trinidad and I want to sing some Kitchener for them." And I was thinking of doing Pan and Harmony. What do you think? And I was like, no. And I thought about her and you know, I said, Margie is what you have to go.
That was it. Yeah. I mean, it was
kill him. You'll kill him with that.
Yeah. You know, the accent and the morning duster, and it was beautiful. Right. Yeah. And then in the middle of this, well, it was like an 8-minute set. And then she turns to the drummer husband and says, "Rumba." And just change the whole. It was beautiful.
Right.
It was beautiful. How do you,
you know, we have a version of that. I have a version of that online. We did at Cotton Club
in Japan. Yes, I noticed that. Yeah,
and she goes, you know, we just go into the Montuno at the end, and she starts singing in Spanish and everything.
Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah.
She's gone. Yeah. You know, when I first heard Jenny sing Rumba, I went, wow, this is for me. You know,
yeah,
and
she was
always part of everything we do.
I heard on your record, and she came the following year to the University of Trinidad and Tobago to do some classes and perform with the orchestra there. And I just said, the hell was this? I just met her and just said, listen, I want you on my show next year. And we set it up. To fly from Nice to Trinidad is not easy. You have to fly like 3 countries before you get to Trinidad at a reasonable cost. But she came, she performed, and she was luckily able to get back to Nice. So I was very happy, but it was amazing. But as we talk about duets, I'm just wondering, I know you've done the range of performances, orchestral, all that kind of thing. Two pans playing side by side, is that something that is in your wheelhouse, or is that's probably the wrong word? Is that something down the road for you, or is that you're just content with what you're doing now?
Anything is possible. I don't rule anything out at this point, mm-hmm. But I've always been kind of focused on, I've tended to shy away from projects where it was about me and another pan soloist, sort of like feeling like, I guess I would compare it to saying like, I grew up listening to Miles, mm-hmm. all right? And Miles would have a saxophone.
Okay.
And a piano and a bass and a drummer. And you would try to picture Miles with just a second trumpet in the band.
Yeah, it does make sense.
You know, and it's just another thing, it's a whole different thing. And for me, I guess I always felt that way. And some is like, I want to see what I can do as a soloist here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, this use of pan sections and steel band music is totally fascinating for me, and that's something I want to keep.
You
want to
develop
on
it, yeah. I hear you.
And but I think the most enjoyable duet I ever played with another pan player was with Earl Rodney.
Ah, but
yeah,
the master.
Earl's a magician with those four sticks,
mm-hmm.
And his whole harmonic concept. And it's funny because, I play a super modern sounding pan, and he plays a super kind of slightly out of tune 70s Alan Gervais pan that he keeps in tune. And so it's a little difficult to make the sound work, but just musically we hear each other.
He's brilliant. No two ways about it. You certainly did a lot of pioneering work with his first band, early recordings. And I as you rightly said, that four sticks playing, I mean, there's some other musicians doing it.
Yeah.
I've never seen you do it, but Mikhail Salcedo pops instantly into my head as one of those musicians who has a facility with four sticks.
Yeah.
Very good. Jason Batiste is another one.
You know, another guy I want to take a little credit for bringing him out of retirement by asking him to play with me was Ray Holman. I'd have a tenor pan and a double second on stage, and he'd be at the gig. I'd get him up to play with me and stuff. And
I think I
helped nudge him back, and we got him the gig. And I brought him out to the WDR gig where with David Rutter and Peter Erskine and Luis Conte and all those guys. And Ray did some soloing, and we did his music. And, it was kind of, I really feel like I helped push him back out on stage to go play pan again. And he's taking it on, he's raising to it.
Just literally last week, Saturday.
But when I met him, he wasn't hardly playing pan anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had retired, but literally last week, Saturday, Etienne Charles had a concert in Trinidad.
I saw.
And he played music of Kitchener, and Ray was there. And Ray, as a composer, as you rightly said, is pioneer.
I love Ray's music. You know, like when Ray and I hang out together, basically I play piano, he plays pan,
mm-hmm.
and we play Ray's music and we play Kitchener music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's like we could go all night with
all
those
night.
Two composers.
Mm-hmm.
And we just connect that way.
As it is, you pick the two best composers of music for pan. Hey, we could do this all night long. But, Andy, I want to thank you very much for this conversation. I think I wanted to get an understanding of your position and your place in the pan world. Yeah, there are detractors. You will face slings and arrows, but I know you're bigger than that because my thing is the proof is in the recording. That's my mantra.
Mm-hmm.
And as many, we may have had many pioneers, but somewhere along the line, even if you work in the independent system, you don't have part of a label system, make a goddamn record. Because the record is proof after you're gone. 18, 19 records as a leader, two with Caribbean's Jazz Project, two with Sake Show, one with Steel Bandits. I'll keep harping on that. And many collaborations with some South Africans. I was checking out some of the music I had done with some musicians from South Africa. And with Janizet, and it's beautiful music, and you haven't stopped. And of course, with this new development with the sample library, the possibilities are almost endless, right?
Mm.
But I'm very keen in following up that trajectory of the music recordings, because I still believe that's what makes the music industry go wrong. Recordings, recordings, recordings. And certainly if you're doing jazz, as I've seen.
Well, I think we have to remember, for me, the transition now is like from recording to like video,
Well, yes, definitely.
And realizing that in order to be relevant now, you've got to have video online.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
very much.
You can't just make records anymore.
I'm a huge fan. I what's his name? William Agitator. He was a jazz aficionado and head of a Hilton Hotel, and he probably was a promoter of the early Pan Jazz Festival that we had in Trinidad. His brother Alfred. But he passed about a year or two ago, and his collection of over 1,500 CDs ended up acquiring it. So 1,500 CDs of jazz recordings. Cool. And I recognize, but I can't play all. There's no way I'm going to play all, but I've been able to read a lot of the things. A lot of musicians just went and did gigs. An engineer came, set up a recording, and recorded them. And I've been telling our musicians, record. And now, as you rightly say, get somebody who knows how to handle a video camera so that you can be seen making music and things. But that's what it is. So, Andy, once again, thank you very much for this conversation. I hope we talk again, and I know we will talk again. And if not...
Sure, man. Anytime.
Again. Sure. All the best. Okay?
Island Jazz Chat has been a production of Jazz in the Islands magazine, powered by iRadio.tt.